Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful, beautiful, neg, black and white, chrome, you name it, instant film. A lot of cool stuff going on with Fujifilm. Check out their great website over at FujifilmUSA.com. Making life more colorful. Great stuff with Fuji. And of course, Richard Photo Lab for the place to send your digital files, your negatives, your chrome, you name it. These guys can process everything in multiple processes. You name it. Great stuff going on at Richard Photo Lab, used by a lot of the really famous rock and roll photographer guys, wedding and portrait people. Just a lot of great stuff going on with Richard Photo Lab there in Hollywood on Melrose. You can check them out over at richardphotolab.com. Our buddies over at Upstrap for the coolest camera strap will not let your camera slide off your shoulder. Check them out over at upstrap-pro.com and our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group. The place on the web to find out about all photographic processes that are traditional, real, analog photography, darkroom, large format, ultra large format, 35, camera building, you name it, everything going on with the traditional photographic process is discussed over at APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. We got a great show lined up for today. We have with us today Steve Anchell. Steve is the author of the Darkroom Cookbook. Really cool stuff going on, of course, with Steve. A great book. It's now in its third iteration. This is a brand new book. This is not a rev of one, a rev of two. This book, version three of the Darkroom Cookbook, has been completely rewritten from scratch. This is an awesome book. There's a lot of great formulas. A lot of people have contributed to this book. This is a gathering of everybody in the traditional silver-based photographic community that have come together to actually put this stuff down on paper, to verify these formulas, and just have a great piece of literature that helps the whole photographic community. So we're going to talk to Steve about, of course, the new Darkroom Cookbook, his photography, and all this great stuff going on. Hey, Steve, how you doing today?
Hi, thank you, Scott, and yourself?
Very good here. Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Steve, you're the author of the Darkroom Cookbook. It's in the third edition now. You've been doing photography for many, many years. You're working on a lot of great projects now. Steve, let's talk about yourself. Tell me how you got into photography and how did it bring you together to be able to do, of course, the Darkroom Cookbook and all the other great stuff that you're working on.
Oh, well, how I got into photography, I think, is an interesting story because it's not the norm. I was actually thought I was going to be teaching backpacking when I grew up in the Sierra Nevadas, and I was working for a backpacking store. I wrote an article for a magazine that had just come out a couple years earlier called Backpacker. This was in the 1960s. It was a story about equipment, and the editor sent me a check for $25 and wrote me a note. I illustrated the next story. He'd make it $100 plus $25 per photo. Well, I was making $60 a week working for this backpacking store full-time and backpacking on weekends. So I got a camera. I liberated my father's Kodak Retina. He never got it back, by the way, and went up to the Sierra Nevadas and photographed a backpacking trip. Came back, developed the transparency film, and they were all yellow. Turned out there was a yellow filter on it for black and white, and I didn't know you're supposed to take it off. So that's how I started photography. I found I was more fascinated by the photographic process and recording the world around me than I was in backpacking, and I've never been back.
Wow. So did you ever get that one story and the $100 from the backpack guy?
Never did. Never wrote another story for Backpacker. That was it. Just got involved in photography.
Well, you have to thank him for that, right? Thanks for the option that got me into photography.
I don't know. You think I should write the guy, or write Backpacker, say I'm one of your former writers? Will you take me back? That was 1968, I think, or 67.
Right. That's very interesting. So let's talk about your interest in photography past that. Did the thing with photography appeal to you most of the mechanical process, the technical process of shooting, developing your own film, working in the darkroom? What sort of spurred your interest the most, of course, after this initial deal with the backpacking magazine?
What fascinated me about photography was recording the world in which I lived, and I became obsessed with that. And 38 years later, I haven't lost that obsession. I just have a need or a compulsion to photograph my life. As I tell people, I photograph to remember. So I can look at a photograph I took in 1972 or 74 or 91. I can look at that image, accurately know the year I took that image in, sometimes a time of year. I can remember who it was, where it was, and what I was doing. Without a photograph, I found that I can't remember anything, including my birthday.
Well, it does help because, you know, like you said, you shot that photo. You can remember where you were, and the photo has the trigger to spur your mind back to say, oh, wait, I remember being there. This is what the deal was, blah, blah, blah. But without some kind of visual reference, it's hard to recall these types of memories.
Henry Miller said that writing is autobiographical. What I believe is that all art is autobiographical, whether it's painting or drawing or writing or photography. But nothing is more autobiographical than photography, because in order to make a photo, you have to be there in proximity to your camera. Even if you're doing it with a remote control unit, you've got to be in proximity to your camera. And that is what you're doing at that moment in your life. Whether it's a fashion photo in a studio, that's what you're doing at that moment. Or a landscape in the Sierra Nevadas, that's what you're doing at that moment in your life.
So like you said, that's the recorded instant in your existence.
Exactly right. Whether you're on a street in Florence or on a trail in the Sierra Nevadas, it's that moment in your life.
With recording all the stuff going around you, Steve, did you have an interest in doing darkroom work, developing your own film, working on chemicals and doing the stuff with the chemistry? Was this something of, I wanted to do it because I liked the craft? Was it more of a deal of, okay, well, I'm going to do it because it's more economically feasible to shoot more photos when I develop my own work? What got Steve involved in the whole darkroom?
You said it exactly. I remember I was making $60 a week working full time. People don't remember that's what we got paid back then. I was a retail clerk at the furniture goods store. And at $60 a week, I could not afford to have film developed. On the other hand, I could buy it in bulk 100 feet. It was very inexpensive, D76, and develop it and print it myself. So being self-taught and not having a lot of extra income, I found that this was a way I could learn photography and teach myself.
Let's start off with, of course, you had the first camera that you borrowed from your father. Where did you move into after that?
Where I go from there, well, my first camera I purchased after that would have been an Olympus OM-1. And I bought that because it was the smallest and lightest camera. And it had just come out, I think, in 72, if I recall, or 73. I bought it specifically for still thinking I was going to do backpacking. Even though I hadn't been backpacking since I started photography, I thought I would eventually get back to it, which I never did. So I purchased that camera. After the OM-1, my very next purchase was a Crown Graphic 4x5, which I used for many, many years. I purchased it for $75 and sold it later for $125. Beat the heck.
See, if you would have bought a bunch of them, you'd made a bunch of good money on that one.
Yeah, I would have made a $50 profit 12 years later. But I used that camera, that 4x5, once I got into that. I used that for everything, commercial assignments, landscapes, portraits. I used that camera for everything. I rarely used 35 after that for many, many years. And eventually moved, I think, in the mid-70s. I got an Agfa Ansco 8x10, began doing 8x10 with contact printing.
Now, did you find that you were limited with the speed graphic that you had? You didn't have a lot of the adjustments you would have in a typical view camera. What it had was enough for what you were doing? No. You didn't find that you were held back by its limitations?
No, I wasn't. Like I said, I did a lot of even architecture, interiors, paid assignments with it. There are ways to use the Crown Graphic. A lot of people don't know. Like one technique is to take the Crown Graphic for an interior, put it upside down so the rise can drop the front standard, and put it up near the ceiling. You drop it down, you miss the light bulbs in the ceiling, but you get the whole room with the wide-angle lens. So there are techniques you can use for that. It's limited in the Scheinflug effect, but even there you can use it to achieve a certain amount of that. For another reason, I didn't know the difference. I didn't own a decent monorail camera. Again, I fell into all this stuff by accident. You know, I'd hear about it here or see something and get interested, buy that camera and try it, start working with it. I learned a lot of techniques from Frank and Donnie Rogers, who also used Crown and speed graphics as well as view cameras. Frank that taught me the upside down from the ceiling technique. So I didn't feel limited because I didn't know any better.
So at any point, you never had any official organized training when it came to your photography. It was all self-taught, or who you could pick up stuff from your friends and your buddies with.
It was mainly picking up stuff like that, hanging around with Frank and Dottie in their studio. Roger Davidson, who was also a friend of Frank Rogers, who processed E3 fit chemistry in his home with his wife Cornelia every night for the top photographers in Los Angeles, from Peter Gallon. Everybody brought their film to him back then, but I learned a lot from him about film processing and printing. He had been a photographer himself. So we learned from books. You're really self-taught. We were learning the knowledge of somebody who wrote that book. In a sense, yes, I'm self-taught in that I assigned myself the books to read or chose them, but I'm not really self-taught in that. I learned from the guys like Davidson, Frank Rogers, and other very fine photographers over the years. Course-wise, I took two courses. One was at Santa Monica City College, and it was a darkroom course. The instructor the first night gave a talk about the Weston handheld photographic meter, and that was the last formal talk he gave. The rest of the time he spent in his office. If you had a question, you could go ask him and just go to the darkroom and print and photograph during the week. 30 years later, I met a group of his students. I was teaching a workshop in Big Sur. I met a group of his students, and I asked him, I told him about this instructor that did it. And they said, he's still doing the same thing. They said, we've been trying to get rid of him, but we can't because he's got tenure. But anyway, the guy 30 years later was still showing that, doing a lecture on the Weston handheld meter and saying, okay, go work in the dock room, bring me your prints. That was my one formal education. And then I took a workshop with a guy who is still alive. I don't want to mention his name. He's venerated photographer. He's in his 80s now. Did a lot of teaching for and with Ansel Adams in the Yosemite workshops. Took this workshop, and it was so bad that I said, if ever I teach a workshop, I will never teach like this guy. And I've done my best not to. So that was really probably the best thing ever happened, because I learned how not to teach. And I think as a teacher, I'm very successful. I have students that come back over and over again.
Steve, let's talk about the Darkroom Cookbook. You've got the brand new third edition is out. It's only been out about a week now. Let's talk about how you got to come together to put the Darkroom Cookbook together in the first place. And how did you start off saying, okay, well, I want to write a book on darkroom chemistry?
Well, around, I think, 1989, I fellow by the name of Tom Harrop, who was the editor at that time of Darkroom Photography Magazine, let me change to Cameron Darkroom, and Tom was the editor, hired me to write an article, which I did on street photography, and then finally did get into writing at that point, began writing for magazines, thanks to Tom. I was looking for ideas. Remember, I've been collecting formulas for years. Guys like Frank or Dottie Rogers, who was our darkroom maven, Frank's wife, would give me formulas and show me tricks. I had another mentor by the name of Helen. I never been able to remember her last name. She was a fine photojournalist who worked and did some work for Life magazine at one time. And she would teach me and let me work in her darkroom in exchange for helping her when she had production assignments. But I collected all kinds of formulas and notes, some of them in my head. And so I had all that. But then one day I was in Sammy's Camera in Los Angeles buying some chemistry. And there was a woman there, and she looked like she was in college. I had some bromide in my hand I was getting for I used for 10% bromide in a developing formula. It's in my book how to do that. And this woman said, well, what is that for? And I just said, well, if you put 10% of this in your package developer you have right there you're about to buy, if you put 10% of that, it would actually improve the quality of the developer. And she said, oh, that's way too technical for me. Well, to me, mixing a 10% solution of bromide was like, I mean, it's just something you do in the darkroom. You don't even think about it. It wasn't a technical thing at all. And I realized then that what was just second nature to me was technical for someone else. And I thought, well, okay, here's a chance for an article on basic darkroom techniques. And I proposed to Tom a series called The Darkroom Cookbook, in which I would talk about things like 10% bromide. And we began that, and eventually, after I had a few of those under my belt, I decided to propose a book to Focal Press, which they agreed to, and in 1994, we came up with a book, The Darkroom Cookbook, which a lot of people don't know this, but there's absolutely nothing technical about The Darkroom Cookbook, and the original book wasn't technical at all, not to me at least, and there's no chemistry in it either. There's some powders and liquids that you mix together in certain amounts, and you have a formula. That doesn't really chemistry.
No, of course. Like you said, you take this chemical, you take this thing, you add 10% here, you mix this up. Now I have this recipe for this tasty developer or this fixer or whatever,
right?
I'm doing.
Like a pancake mix. So all of this. People call and write me emails every day. I get them from all over the world asking me chemical questions. I don't have a clue. I got a D in chemistry in high school. I actually never got better than a D in high school in chemistry. I don't know anything about chemistry.
But the thing is, though, you said, it's a cookbook. This is a cookbook on how to make cool recipes to develop great stuff in the darkroom. It's not a chemistry book on how to do and be a photochemical engineer.
Exactly. And there's a guy in Photo Techniques magazine who would write a column every month on photographic chemistry, which he would give diagrams of the molecular structure of chemicals. Well, if you're into that, that's fine. That is absolutely, totally anathema to me to creative photography. No creative person needs to know that stuff. It's a waste of space in the gray cells. It's great if you're a chemist and that's what interests you. But that's also, by the way, one of the great things about photography. There's something in photography for everybody. There's technical. If you're a technical type person and want to know the chemical structure of the developing formula, well, it's there. If you're into collecting cameras, by goodness, you can collect cameras. If you're into taking pictures, well, you can take pictures. There's something in photography for everybody.
There really is, and I think a lot of this has been lost with some of these newer technologies, but like you said, there's so many things you can do with photography. Let's talk about, Steve, the Darkroom Cookbook now is in its third edition. This is the third time now since the original printing. Tell me what you guys have done from second edition to third edition. What's new in the book?
The first edition was pretty bad in that it was just all these notes and things that I put together, and I wasn't an accomplished writer at the time. I wasn't skilled at writing. I did not do it together, but I really didn't understand how important it was to get the formulas just right and so forth and so on. The second edition, I tried to prove a lot of that, but there were a lot of mistakes in it still in the formulas. I would say to you, I didn't really have the knowledge or the skill. What changed in the third one was I met a guy by the name of Bill Troop, who approached me to co-author with him a book called The Film Developing Cookbook. Bill impressed upon me the importance of being thorough and accurate, which I didn't really appreciate. I was just a sloppy photographer. The difference between anhydrous and monohydrate just didn't mean much to me at the time. So in this edition, thanks to Bill, I've gotten really tight. I had a lot of different people, Ian Grant, Larry Hussar, Mark Booth, Paul Lewis, four very fine and very technically oriented photographers. Look over the formulas. They went over the fine-tooth comb. They found, again, many errors that I had overlooked, corrected the formulas, got them as accurate as possible all the way through the book. I had other people looking at the chapters. I had people like Brad Scully Osterman, Mark Osterman, two of the finest people working in the collodion wet print process and the historical processes for the George Eastman House in Rochester. They looked over the chapter on printing out papers and gave all kinds of recommendations. You have Tim Rudman from England, went through my toner chapter, through most of what I'd written out and rewrote it for me in his own style. Things like that. So I had some really experts. So it wasn't just me anymore. I actually brought other people in. I also realized that photography, going back to the original Darkroom Cookbook, was about preserving these formulas and techniques. And so rather than just the ones I had in my head and rehashing them, I went to people like Bruce Birnbaum and John Sexton, mentioned Tim Rudman and others, Gordon Hutchings, John Wimberley, and asked them, let me hear from you what you have, rather than just these things from old Frank Rogers and Roger Davidson, which go back half a century. And they all contributed to the book. So this book, for the first time, has independent contributions from other photographers, some of the best, I think, working in the world today.
It's great to be able to collaborate with all these people and have everybody want to help. And I think it just shows the community of analog photography on traditional photographic processes where everybody does want to throw in a hand and help and make sure this stuff is right. To be able to fine-tune this book, it's like a piece of fine wine now. It's been aged and it's all completely been gone through again. And I think it's more than just the third edition. It's not just, well, we printed it another time because we ran out of books. This is basically, it's an all-new book. You've gone through this whole thing from top to bottom.
It is. The first two were about me and about what I knew. This book is about all these other photographers and about things that they go well beyond who and what I am and what my knowledge. Having these contributors was a great boon that has enhanced this book. And I even went so far as to have a representative photo by each of them in the book, not just for the people today who actually know them, but 10, 20 years from now, as we do all fade into memory, people can look at, there's a photograph by the guy that wrote that, and golly, he was a fine photographer, and maybe want to look him up and see more about them at that time. So I didn't just write this for today. This book was written for posterity as much as anything.
I think it's great just to go to show that these other photographers would want to get involved in your book and your project to help fine-tune these recipes for the darkroom, for chemical, to be able to do great work. And it's cool that everybody wants to chip in and help with this. It just shows you the dedication of people that are doing traditional photographic processes is pretty cool.
Well, absolutely. With very few exceptions, everyone who contributed is still doing silver. One or two have moved in partially into digital, but they still have a foot in silver as well. I do some digital, but for myself, if I'm working for myself, it's silver. If I'm working for a client, it's digital. So I'm doing a little bit of both here, but my personal work is still all silver. But most of these guys, like Ryuji and Saeed Musibe, most of these guys are still working mainly in silver.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing too, is that, like you said, they're still working in the silver stuff. And I think later here in the program, I want to get into your thoughts on the future of analog photography in this digital era, because I think some parts of analog photography is actually picking up after it's dipped down with the onset of digital and things are coming back. Right now, though, Steve, let's talk about the book. You have a website set up for the book. It's published by Focal Press. Let's talk about where people can get it, because like you said, if they had version one or even version two of the book, version three is really, it's a brand new book.
This is a book I wish I could have written when I started. If I had version one and two, I'd throw them away and get this book. This is that much better.
I think people need to realize, too, with the way that publishing works in the United States, throughout the whole world, is when a book like this comes out, this is fresh. This book's been out literally about a week or two. Maybe It's been shipping 10 days. So the initial sales of this type of book would indicate to a publisher of, okay, well, this thing did pretty well. Let's look at doing other types of analog photography books because, hey, this is not really dead. We can make some more great content here. So I think people do need the book because, A, it's all new. It's completely gone through. It's a new book. So forget if you had version one or two, but I think too, it actually helps support the whole photographic analog based community, because it gives a key to publishers like Focal Press and other people that do traditional photography books of like, hey, maybe there is something left here in the darkroom. Maybe we can do some other content that people would like to read.
Well, you are correct. And that is how publishers think. People don't realize with the computer age, they look at the first 2 weeks of sales. First 2 weeks of sales, that surge tells them, and pre-sales as well, whether or not there is an out market for a particular subject. Silver-based photographers really want to promote silver and send a message to the publishers. They do it with their pocketbook, which is something John Sexton used to say. And they do it by purchasing this book and saying, we want more books like this. There's a market. And what's important about that is, even though there's an interest in it, you will not find any mainstream photo magazine publishing any articles on silver. They just don't feel that their readers want that. On the other hand, it's a catch-22, because by only publishing digital articles, no silver photographer is going to buy their magazine. So that limits them to the people interested in digital. But if the silver people can send a message that they do want things on silver, that may come around.
Plus, we need to let people know that, yes, it's great that you wrote the book. It's great you're making some dough on it. But if people go out and buy a copy of this book, it's not like we're pandering to say, well, let's give Steve more money, because Steve's already been paid in advance on the book. And he's got to sell enough copies to even break even. So it's not that we're trying to say, let's give Steve a bunch more money. We want to keep silver-based photography alive and the traditional photographic process cooking along. And actually, like we said, have publishers have an interest in doing more work like this. And that's why I think people really need to go update their copy. And this is more of, besides getting a great book with some great recipes in it for doing your own development, it actually helps out the whole silver-based photography industry and photographers themselves.
Well, let's talk about that. I may say some things that aren't tactful or politically correct here, or you're not supposed to say. From the time of the first darkroom cookbook in 1994, which was considered a bestseller for photo books, until today, it has sold approximately somewhere around the 12,000 copies. Now, from what I've been told by the publisher, digital books, when they come out on like Photoshop, will sell in the first year 20,000 to 30,000 copies. So anyone who may think, and I don't think there are a lot of people who think that way, but if there is someone who thinks that Ann Schell is going to make a lot of money off this book and retire young,
right,
it's not going to happen. Not only that, but Focal Press was not certain that they wanted to take a chance on another darkroom book. So they didn't pay me in advance. I wrote this book without an advance.
Oh, wow.
Now, yeah, that's not usually done, because I usually get a pretty good advance when I write other things. They didn't want to do that. So they're waiting to see if it makes any money. If it doesn't, of course, I get nothing. If it does, I do get something. But what do I get? In the heyday of photography, before digital was even dreamed of, we're talking about 1994 until now, we've sold about 12,000 copies. So if anybody thinks that I'm going to get rich off this book, they're thinking wrongly. The whole purpose of promoting this book and writing it without an advance is to keep darkroom alive and preserve these formulas for those of us who wish to continue, and perhaps those in the future who may wish to rediscover it. As I say in that preface, consider platinum and palladium. Platinum and palladium at the turn of the last century and up to about the 1920s, mid-20s, was the process used by everyone. Edward Weston, Ansel Adams, Edward Steichen, everybody used platinum and palladium. Silver came along and it was much more convenient, and many of your diehards like Edward Weston refused to even try it. Eventually they did, and eventually they liked it, and they stopped using platinum. Platinum just about disappeared. There were no books, or there were only little pamphlets and leaflets and little things written about platinum palladium, and most of it was passed down from photographer to photographer. So many techniques in platinum palladium have disappeared, and they're being rediscovered the hard way by your new generation, starting actually in about the 1970s. It's been hard because nobody had preserved this stuff. The Darkroom Cookbook is meant to preserve this so we don't have to rediscover silver in 10 to 20 years.
Steve, let's give them the address here. We're going to give it again out, of course, at the end of the program here, but let's give them where they need to go. You have a website set up for the book. You have some forums. You have some discussion stuff going on. Let's give them the website for the book so they can actually go look at this stuff and check it out while they're listening to this if they want to at the same time.
Well, the forum is at darkroomcookbook.com. And what's interesting about this forum, I've reached out to photographers. I made it available to the contributors to the book to have their own personal forum under the main forum. So, for example, you have Jay Dussard has a forum on, tentatively on bleaching, but actually he can talk about anything he wants. You've got Larry Hussar, who did a lot of technical editing of the formulas, has a forum, and he wants to talk about the autochrome process, which he's very interested in. So he's got his own form with his name on it, and people are going to write out these questions about these things. David Wood did a chapter for me on reversal processing, and which is new to this book. And he's got a form, so he wants to talk about reversal processing, color all black and white. They can write David on this form. I don't think anybody knows about it yet because we've had only one post so far. But it is there, darkroomcookbook.com. Everybody's welcome to join. You have to register my website to be able to post, but you can read without registering, you can read what's being posted.
I think it's a great, great resource for this. And I also want to touch off on now, Steve, about your thoughts on the future of analog photography. You know, everything's going digital. Everybody wants a digital camera. Everybody wants to spend 4,000 hours into Photoshop. I mean, what's your thoughts here on silver-based photography moving forward in the onset of all the things that's going on in the land of digital?
Well, like it or not, silver-based photography is going to become marginalized, just as platinum and palladium did. They're still following in platinum and palladium, and hopefully silver will never recede the way platinum and palladium did. It's going to become marginal like that. Digital is the future. It is now, and it's what people want, and it is money-based. Anybody who has a successful product in digital, whether it's a camera, media card, is set up to make lots and lots of money very quickly, and that's what motivates people to make things. Anybody who makes an enlarger, they sell them once, and people keep them for 20, 30 years. You make a Nikon D3, and in about a year, it's going to be a D4, and you've got to sell your D3. But anyway, digital is a money-making proposition. Silver is not. So right away, you have an industry that's not going to support it, the manufacturing industry. However, it's not going to go away, because if somebody's going to buy film and paper, someone such as Ilford or the Eastern Bloc countries or even China making their black and white film under the brand Lucky are going to continue to make it. It'll be here. It'll be here for us. And there are guys like Ron Mowry who are writing about how to make your own emulsions. So there'll be people like that out there. They're very knowledgeable and are willing to share their knowledge. In fact, I think Ron is hooking up with Bill Troop, my old co-author, to do something with this now. But anyway, having said that, silver will be with us for many, many, many years to come. But it's going to be marginalized. Digital is what people are doing. And part of that is, what is photography used for? It's used commercially. Well, if you're a commercial person, the only thing you should be doing is digital. I wouldn't be doing anything but digital commercially. In fact, I do digital commercially right now. If you're a photojournalist, used to all be black and white. Well, now anybody doing photojournalism is going to do digital because it can be uploaded and sent to the newspaper or the magazine instantly. Many newspapers are going to video, taking clips out of that. So that leaves silver behind. Then you've got your snapshot of your family snapshots, which is most of the photography done in the world today. Well, everybody's got their little Casio or Canon SureShot that fits in their pocket, hold it out 2 feet in front of their face and take pictures of their family when they go to a vacation. And that's where most of your photography is done anyway. So that's all digital. In other words, silver has already become marginalized. That doesn't mean it will disappear. However, what it does mean is those of us still working in silver, our work is that much more valuable. Not to say that digital won't find its way into galleries as it already has, but that being done in silver has more value because it is going to be rare, and the people working in it are going to become fewer.
Yeah, and I think, too, there's people now that have been shooting digital now since they really started, digital really got popular, let's say, in 98, 2000. They have a discontent with the every 18-month upgrade cycle of spending $3,000 to $7,000, $8,000 to buy a new body. And a lot of people have actually switched back over to silver-based photography just because of the cost of the gear to keep on top of technology. You keep chasing Moore's Law, you're going to spend a lot of money.
Let us not fool ourselves. Photography has never been a poor man's sport or avocation. You don't see many photographers coming out of the ghettos unless some altruistic organization gives a poor child a camera and encourages them at the boys club or something like that to use it.
So true. Yeah.
To be a photographer, you've got to have the price of admission. Before digital, that meant $300, $400, $500 for a camera. Or you could buy a used one for $100 or whatever, but eventually, just like me, making $60 a week, and I do my own developing and printing because I couldn't afford the labs. Again, it wasn't struggling to do that. Everything I made extra went to buy paper and film at that time, back in the early 70s. But it has never been a poor man's sport, and it is less so now. Well, yes, cameras are exponentially more expensive, quantum leap more expensive than they were whenever you could buy a good camera for $400 or $500. Now you need at least $1,500 to $2,000. Even with inflation, it's out of line. And the interesting thing is, to my understanding, it costs less to make a digital camera than it does to make a film camera. I don't mean the top of the line, but I'm talking about the lower level camera. You get to a D3, it costs a lot to get that kind of technology in there. But you also pay for the R&D, or research and development, as well, for that. You're paying that off for these people. But then, as you say, within a year or so, you've got to replace it with the newest one, the newest megapixels, the faster, whatever. I don't mean to digress, but I use a Minolta 7D. 6 megapixels has been made in 5 years or so. I do commercial assignments with it, and my clients are happy, high-quality work. And yet we feel we have to keep buying more and more megapixels and bigger and better cameras. But part of it is, I think photographers are caught up in the frenzy of that. As far as people going back, I teach a lot. I teach darkroom workshops. I have a great 4 and larger darkroom in my home, and I teach Photoshop. But I have a lot of my students who have started with digital and have come back, and are now a lot of them are using large format because they say, I sit in front of a computer all day long. I relate really well to this large format screen, the 4x5 screen, but I really am tired of sitting in front of a computer because it's too much like work. I don't want to do my creative stuff in front of a computer. I want to do something where I do something different. So they're coming back to photography. I'm not seeing a mad rush for that, but I do see it, and I see it on a fairly regular basis.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we've interviewed a lot of photographers that are professional wedding photojournalist photographers, and they've went and changed their workflow fully to film. Just because they can nail it in camera, they know how to do exposure, they know how to do correct photography. And I think that's one thing that maybe we can touch on too, is people that are shooting digital don't have, or if they've not shot film, or if you haven't said, okay, well, go shoot a case of chrome and come back and see me, they don't know how to do stuff correctly with digital. They can shoot raw and fix it in Photoshop. But these other guys that are shooting the wedding stuff have gone exclusively to film. They've used it as a niche in their marketing because they have the organic, they have the original photographic look with film, and if they do it right, they don't have any post-production work. The stuff gets scanned in a hybrid workflow, and they send the files to the lab, and guess what? They might have a few minutes in Photoshop or use something in Aperture or Lightroom to sort their photos, but they move on. They don't spend all day at Photoshop.
You bring up many very important things here. I mean, there's almost more than I can touch on, but you are right about one thing. Digital has made the life of the commercial photographer, the wedding photographer, much more difficult, not easier. Because before, everything did go to a lab, you just waited until it came back, or you paid a rush charge, whatever, and you didn't do any work that in. Now, we are required, because there's no lab that can really do the processing of our 1,000, 2,000 digital files we have for our clients. So we end up having to do it, or we have to hire somebody to do it. You could make an argument we used to hire lab people to work in our labs, but still, we didn't have to do that. We could take it to an outside lab. Now we can't. So our time and energies are really sucked into that machine, that computer.
You know, you spend so much time in the computer, and I think people are like, okay, you know something? I love the look of film. I can shoot 400 neg at 200 or even at 100, one or two stops overexposed. I have this look now that everybody's doing with actions in Photoshop. I have excellent saturation. I have great sharpness. I have a dreamy muted color. I can do whatever I want by the way that I can manipulate my emulsion in the camera, how I want to shoot it, how I want to do this. They can shoot it and scan it, and guess what? They can still get their digital album. You can still get your digital prints. You can still put stuff online, but you know something? They get to go home and hang out with their family at night, and they're not stuck in front of a Photoshop box for 1,000 hours.
Well, that's a good point in that I think that you're seeing more and more a lot of hybrid work, too, like that. People working with film for their original and then scanning and printing that way. I've done that myself. I teach a nude workshop. I don't know if you know, but I've been teaching figure photography, I think, longer than anybody in the world that I know of, since 1982, continuously. But the thing is, I photograph my models with film, develop it. If I'm shooting a show, I will make a silver print. But for the models, I scan the film and then give them a quick print in Photoshop, you know, on an inkjet and 2400 inkjet printer, which is convenient for me to do that. But I don't show anything. I would not show anything that's an inkjet print. I only show silver prints for myself. The models are happy with that. So there's a hybrid thing going on there. I don't know how much you want to talk about digital, but I would say this, that the digital process is inherently a color process and is inherently a point-and-shoot process. And I don't care how advanced your Nikon D3 is. It is a point-and-shoot process. And I would say that inherently it is a Photoshop process. Digital is not about photography. It is about Photoshop. All your digital camera is, and again, I say the top-of-the-line digital camera. By the way, you know, I did a review of the Nikon D3 when it first came out for Shutterbug Magazine. And all I can tell you, it is a really high-powered point-and-shoot with a lot of point-and-shoot features. All you do is snap the shutter, record the image. Then you go to Photoshop, and you do all your color corrections. You do all your sharpening, all your this, that, and the other. It's all done in Photoshop. Digital is a Photoshop process. It is color, and it is point and shoot. Now, there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you want.
So I guess the question is here, Steve, then is, okay, let's get to this point then. So if you want to look at it that way, is digital photography really digital photography, or should we be calling this digital imaging and it's not a true photograph?
I call it digital imaging, by the way. Now, this insults some people, so I try to be politically correct with that. When I say photography, I'm just telling you, I mean silver.
Right.
And yet I realize the photography encompass is digital now. When I say digital, I mean digital imaging. In fact, in my articles, if you'll read them, I use digital imaging to refer to digital photography.
I think if you look up, though, in the dictionary of what a photographic process is, it's not digital. Digital is imaging. You know, it's interesting, and I think we can bring this up, that it really doesn't matter off topic, but it just popped in my head that if you've noticed that Popular Photography, an imaging magazine, changed their name just back to Popular Photography. And I don't know why this is, because digital photography is digital imaging. And there's a difference between imaging and photography. I'm sure we'll get some hate mail, so, you know, bring it on, that's fine.
You have a situation that began, and I really, if you look at it historically, it is very similar to the situation in the 1800s when photography was struggling to prove that it was an art form. This is in the early days before Stieglitz, or when Stieglitz was coming up, Alfred Stieglitz, fighting to claim its right as fine art, was being slammed down, and so guys who were doing photography were struggling to prove themselves. You have almost the same situation. Digital imagers came up from a really low self-image in which they had to prove that they were as good as silver photographers. They do everything they can to put silver photography down. And it's been a struggle. They've been very vicious about it. The former editor of Outdoor Photographer magazine was the worst of all. He still writes for Outdoor. You cannot read a single editorial by him when he was editor, or a single article by him now, in which in at least one paragraph he doesn't say something bad about film photography. He almost always likes to refer to the smelly old darkroom days. And I don't think he was in the darkroom after he graduated from college. I mean, you know, he's
right.
Basically a writer, but he loves to slam photography. You will see this in all your magazines. There's always a writer in almost every magazine, at least one, who slams film. You don't see film writers slamming digital. In silver, we have talked about, well, digital hasn't come of age. It's not good enough yet. It has a lot of noise. But as digital's gotten better, I'll be the first to admit, I think the full-frame digital D3 DSLRs, the color and the reproduction and the quality and what you can get out of them in terms of manipulation and color is better than anything we ever got from Kodachrome. That's my opinion.
I have to admit with you, I've used the D3 on many of occasions. I shot a wedding with it in Orlando at Disney. I walked around Disney World with that camera, basically 6400 ISO at night in the dark, taking beautiful photos. You have to admit, for a digital camera, this new technology that Nikon has with the D3, the 1DS Mark III from Canon, the 1D Mark III, some of the stuff these guys are doing is incredible technology, and it's great. I think there's a place for that. I definitely think there's a place for silver-based traditional process.
This is what I am saying. Silver doesn't have to go away for digital to succeed, and yet you have people out there, digital imagers, who feel that they have to constantly slam silver to prove that they're as good as, and that they are as artists just like we are, and that who needs silver anymore? The fact is, there are a lot of good things about digital. There are a lot of good things about silver. One is not inherently better than the other. One does something, I think, again, digital does color really well. It's a color process. Silver does other things very well. It's really a choice. Do you want to sit in front of a computer, watch your butt spread out, have your eyes go back? I don't know a single digital imager that knew more than 10, 20 years that doesn't have a big, fat butt and bad eyes. Now, I've had bad eyes since the fourth grade, but mine haven't changed one bit. And do you want that, or do you want to walk around in a dark room and hear the water flow, stick your hand in the cool water, hear your music playing, whatever you like? W. Gene Smith liked the hardest jazz he could get, like Coltrane at his worst, and other photographers like Ansel Adams, like Chopin. But what do you want to do? Do you want to print in a dark room, or do you want to work in front of a computer? And by the way, I kind of put digital down there, but that was my slam for digital. Having said that, there's nothing wrong with it. If that's the way you want to create, then by goodness, sit in front of a computer and create that way. You can do beautiful work with digital.
You can. And I know a lot of guys that are shooting digital that just create. I mean, here's an example. John Paul Caponegro.
There's no better digital imager than John Paul Caponegro. He is as fine as they get.
And look at his dad. Won't touch digital with a 10-foot pole.
Paul Caponegro is an old friend of mine.
Right.
I knew him before I knew John. Paul is one of the finest photographers working. I reference him in my book about it as a chef when it comes to the darkroom. So Paul and John, the father and son, one is a great, great digital imager, and one is a great, great silver photographer. They are not mutually exclusive, and the two even still talk to each other. In fact, they live right next door to each other, last I heard.
They do. They have a ranch there in Maine. It's pretty neat that they work together. Yeah. But you know something? John Paul has respect for his father, and his father has respect for what he's doing. John doesn't want to do what John Paul's doing, and John Paul doesn't want to come near no silver. So guess what? It's fine.
Image. It's the image that matters. And how you get to that image, whether it's digital or silver, makes no difference. It's the artist who decides whether they use watercolor or oil or acrylic or charcoal. It is the artist that decides whether they use silver or digital. And I will go back to saying that I constantly see in writing, and this I'm sensitive to this because I'm a writer myself, I constantly see digital writers or digital imagers slamming silver as if it were an inferior process. And this doesn't benefit anybody. It would be like somebody in the oil painting magazine slamming watercolor. They're both recognized and viable mediums. And an artist has to decide, and sometimes artists do both. In fact, most oil painters do watercolor and vice versa.
Hey, I shoot plenty of digital, and I shoot a lot of analog. I mean, it's probably more analog these days than digital, but, you know, like I said, if I'm going to go do a certain gig, I have no problem picking up a D3 or the 1DS Mark III and going out and shooting an event because I know I need to turn these photos, the stuff needs to go to an editor, or needs to go online, and it's done. If I'm going to go out and I want to have fun, I'm going to grab my Polaroid 600 SE with some Fuji pack film, and I want to go peel some chemical in the parking lot.
You
whatever you're into.
That's exactly right. And one does not have to die or go away for the other to succeed.
No, and I think a lot of the problems, Steve, that people have that are digital imagers, that they've never shot film, they don't understand film, they don't know about it. It's a secret black art, and people that don't understand things want to put it down and say that it's garbage.
I don't agree with you. The current generation of writers, and they're going to pass away, by the way, as we all will, but the current generation, the most recent generation, have all had experience in the darkroom. I know took courses in college in darkroom. I do not think he did much with it after that. He may have dabbled in it. But this is not a man with a lot of experience in the darkroom, but it's not a mystery to him. And yet in every article, you will not read one article in which he does not say, have one paragraph that says something bad about silver. They've been doing this for about 10 years that I know of. These guys feel they have to do something to hurt silver. Most of the people that I read, who I have any respect for, writing about digital, and that doesn't mean what they write isn't good stuff. The guys that are slamming silver have almost all had some experience in the darkroom. Almost all. Now, you're going to see that change, as you say, as more and more young people come up, take their place as writers, and have now used the darkroom. But I will bet you anything that the young guys who have never had darkroom experience won't slam silver. They won't even think about it. It doesn't exist for them.
Yeah, because they don't know silver, so they might not actually, you're right, they might not take it. They're not going to even bring it up because it's not an issue.
You look at guys like Eddie Tapp, who's a very fine writer on digital, writes for a lot of magazines. He never mentions silver. He doesn't need to. He's very confident and comfortable with what he does in silver and digital, and he's great, good at it. Well, the guys are not really comfortable as photographers. They're more writers than they are photographers. These are the guys that are slamming it. But unfortunately, that's the medium, that's the press, and that's what people read. Just like Eastman Kodak did more to destroy film than anybody in the world. Eastman Kodak in 1982 made a corporate decision that they were going to move over to digital. Part of that was they got a contract for millions and millions and millions of dollars. I may have been in billions, I don't know, for the U.S. military to develop a digital camera back in, I think, 82. At that point, they decided that digital was the future and that they were going to phase out silver. And they thought they could do it within a decade as they brought in digital. Well, they never succeeded in that. In fact, worldwide, if it were not for silver, but without worldwide sales of color film, Eastman Kodak would have gone out of business 20 years ago because they lost so much on digital over the years that this is what kept them afloat. Well, what happens, though, is that from 1982 until today, every year, Eastman Kodak would make pronouncements, something to the effect, and increasingly to the effect, that film was dead, long live digital, basically trying to promote their digital products and research. Now, these pronouncements were published in the Wall Street Journal. If you were an investment and the biggest film manufacturer in the world said film is dead, long live digital, what are you going to invest in? You start putting your money into digital products. So right away, investment started to move away from silver. But another thing happened is what I said. Eastman Kodak paired their digital with their silver. Rather than make it a separate entity, they put the two together. They were connected. This had a lot to do with research and development. The money for research and development then went away from people like Grant Haste and other great photochemists working for Kodak, and went into engineers out of college who were going to make digital cameras. So they tied the two. So the money was siphoned off into digital. That's why I said about keeping them afloat. And finally, what Eastman could have done, had they been wanted to, was say, digital is the future, but film is still a valid medium, and promoted both. But they didn't. They only promoted digital. And little by little, they began dropping their silver line until now, basically, they have a couple of homogeneous films. That is, process and tracks. You can hardly tell the difference. And then they have three of the worst films ever made, which are their T-Max films. And that you're going to get some screams from. I don't care what people say. T-Max is an inferior film by any standard, and it's a very cynical thing on the part of Kodak to make it. It's a total money-making ploy. The fact that the filmmakers fall for it is always incredible to me. But that they can't see that there's a T-Max in a good, conventional film. Tri-X has become very much like T-Max. It's not T-Max yet, but it's very similar to it now. Anyway, the point is, Kodak has done more to kill film and silver than any company. I tell photographers, once again, speak with your money. Support Ilford. Support Efke. Support FOMA. Don't buy from Kodak. And they scream. One photographer said, well, I worked for Kodak, and they were a great company to work for. How can you say that? I don't care what good company they work for. I'm talking about what they've done to kill silver. Why support a company that has done everything it can to destroy silver over a little company like Ilford that's struggling to survive? Give Ilford your money.
They do have some great silver black and white stuff.
Well, they do. And people are like, well, I like the Kodak stuff better. Fine, you like it better? Well, Kodak's your enemy. I don't care what you like. You start using Ilford, and within about a couple of months, you'll get used to it, and you won't see the difference. In fact, except that it's better. But people fight me on that all the time. I like Kodak. I always use Tri-X. The Tri-X you're using today is not the Tri-X that was introduced in the 1950s, nor was it the Tri-X that was in the 1980s. It's using tabular grain films and a lot of the color dyes to increase its sensitivity. And these take away from the quality that made it Tri-X. So people don't think about those things. They say, oh, it's got the name Tri-X on it. It must be good. Nonsense. Kind of opinionated.
What do you think with Fuji's offerings in black and white?
Now, with Fuji, it comes down to personal taste. It's like guys, that are with Kodak, guys that are with Ilford, guys with Fuji. I think Fuji makes a very good product. I think their Acros is a very good product. I don't use it because I've been with Ilford for so many years. So it's hard for me to speak on that. I hate to do it because I think Fuji does a good job. But I've not experienced enough with it to say. And Fuji themselves have done more to support silver than anybody other than Ilford. And so I appreciate that.
Great stuff going there. Excellent stuff. They have a great product. Steve, let's talk about where people can find out more information about what you're doing. We definitely want to have you on the program again, talking about some of the other things. And also, we will have you on Inside Digital Photo talking about your digital photography. You're doing a lot of training. You're doing some great classes. You're doing a lot of stuff with Photoshop. And of course, you're still doing great work in silver. So where would I find out more information about Steve Inchell, what you're up to, of course, the new Digital Darkroom book, and everybody, they can just find out the great work you're doing. They can look at your photography. I know you're doing workshops. Steve's got a lot of great stuff going on.
Well, steveanchell.com would be fine. And also, if you go to that, there's a link to the forum at the top of the page, so you can go right to the forum from there. That's where you'll find my workshops. I've got my annual Nude at West Winds workshop comes up in May. That's a very good one. I'm going to be teaching street photography in New York again. The International Center of Photography used to fly me out to New York to teach street photography once a year. By the way, I always use a Leica for that. Leica is my favorite camera. The Leica M7 or the M3 was my original. I still use it. Usually my workshops, I'm basically using my Leica film camera. I'll be teaching that again in October of next year, doing street photography, and then I teach private workshops. I've got a student coming from Michigan Sunday for a week, a darkroom workshop. People from around here come for darkroom and large negatives, learn how to do that. But you can see that stuff on my website.
I think that's great, and I think it's cool that you actually are doing instructional workshops in the darkroom, and you can do this one-on-one.
I do it one-on-one, and I do it one-on-four. Sometimes I'll have a darkroom weekend. That's really for the local area. Somebody come down here for 2 days. Some of us come for 5 days. I have people come from as far away as Singapore and from Germany, Canada. I had a family of three come from Canada to learn darkroom work recently. So I have people come from all over for darkroom. So I can do one or I can do up to four is what it comes down to.
This is great stuff you're doing. It's just so nice to chat with you today, Steve, to talk about the new version of the book. And it really is a brand new book that I really think people need to support what's going on with this book, because it's going to continue to make silver-based photography publications available. People will still be able to learn and read about this great process. And it's just neat that you put this much time into this process to share with this stuff, including all the work you're doing and the great stuff you're doing too with digital. It's just really cool.
Thank you, Scott. When I get rich off of the book sales, I'll share it with you.
Steve, I really appreciate it. We definitely look forward to having you back, talking more stuff. There's 1,000 things that we could talk about when it comes to the dark room and things that are going on. We're definitely going to have Steve back talking about what you're doing. But I think right now you're best to go to your website and find out the book. Or you can go to Amazon. I guess it really doesn't matter where you get the book.
I prefer people go to the Focal Press website, which is elsevier.com. Focal itself will make more money. Talk about money. I mean, again, we're not getting rich here. But Amazon takes 55% of the book cost. Focal doesn't get that then. Focal gets 100% if they buy it from Focal. And the Focal website is elsevierdirect.com. And you type in Welcome Cookbook, and it'll take you to a page where you can order. And Focal gets 100% of the money. My percentage is the same, by the way, whether they sell it to Amazon. But I'd like to see Focal make money off this book. They say, gee, that book not only sold well, but we made money. If they sell to Amazon, they basically just make a few pennies.
Right, and they want to make more because if we can keep the publisher happy, then they will have other people write books, and we'll just be able to keep analog-based silver photography alive and just do cool stuff.
Yeah, the easy way out is to go to Amazon.com, a little bit more to type in Elsevier Direct, but you'll help the publisher that way.
Steve, I really appreciate you joining us today. Great stuff you're working on. We're definitely going to have you back talking more analog photography. And also, if you want to hear about what Steve's up to with digital photography, Steve will also be here coming up soon on Inside Digital Photo. And we'll talk about what he's up to in his Photoshop training, all the great stuff you're doing. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today. Great work you're doing here, buddy.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Well, there you go. Steve Anchell. Great stuff with Steve. A beautiful book, you know, completely redone. I just want to reiterate again that you guys really need to help support the silver-based community. Get a copy of this book. Learn how to do some alternate processes. Cook up some of your own developer, your own fixer, and actually enjoy photography. This is great stuff. Check it out. Go over to Steve's website, darkroomcookbook.com. Great stuff going on there. Of course, I'd like to thank the sponsors of the Inside Analog Photo Radio program, Fujifilm, making life more colorful. You know, like I said before, just great emulsion. These guys are kicking out great stuff, really dedicated to the true photography process. FujifilmUSA.com/professional, making life more colorful. How great is that? And of course, our friends over at Richard Photo Lab, for excellent service on your neg, your chrome, your black and white, you name it, these guys are doing everything. RichardPhotoLab.com, Upstrap over at Upstrap-Pro.com. And of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group, APUG.org, the place on the web to find out everything about traditional photography. You guys should go sign up. It's like $24 a year. It's great support to keep this stuff alive. Shane Ross spends a lot of time, all of his time, 24 hours a day, full-time job to keep this website up so we, his readers, can learn about what's going on and share this information, have a place to go. You know, for the $24, you get a gallery, you get a blog, you get a lot of stuff. You know, it's really cool. It's only going to cost you like $2 a month. It's not that big a deal. It's less than a magazine. You can't even buy a magazine anymore for less than $6 or $7. And it's not going to talk about silver. It's not going to talk about any kind of alternate process. It's not going to talk about anything except digital. So check it out, www.apug.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We've been talking about, of course, the Darkroom Cookbook with Steve Anchell today. Just great stuff going on in the whole land of traditional photographic process. You can find out more information about the show over at www.insideanalogphoto.com.